Welcome to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. And today on your show, three stories of the zigzagging paths to employment and career happiness among people who have experienced mental health challenges. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of Career Cycles, a career management social enterprise, and I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Leading up to George Brown College's mental health conference called From Exclusion to Inclusion, Accessing Employment Through Education, which is coming up on March 1st, today on Career Buzz, you're going to hear a few voices from the conference. David Revel is a psychiatric survivor and consultant on mental health policy. He teaches at Ryerson University in the Disability Studies program. He's been a community activist, a plumbing contractor, a Toronto City Councillor, a member of Provincial Parliament, and Special Advisor to the Premier. David will share his own mental health story of an interrupted education, a long period of poverty and despair related to difficulties in getting and keeping jobs. Teresa Schrader was going to join us this morning. She's the Community Poverty Relief Associate at HAVTA. Unfortunately, she's unwell, and we wish her a speedy recovery. We do have Joe Petit, who's a social worker and faculty member in the Redirection Through Education program at George Brown College. She teaches and develops curriculum in the area of workplace and career support and development. Her focus is on equity and access in employment. And we are also joined this morning by Paul Zanettos, who is the media relations consultant at George Brown College. Joe Petit, David Revel, and Paul Zanettos join me live in studio. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Joe, first, if I could start with you. You work in George Brown's Redirection Through Education program. What do you like about that?
Good question. I guess I like what I've always found really interesting about education is that it supports people in healing and moving forward in their life, and it's a social justice activity. So I like the intersection in Redirection Through Education, which is a transitional program for folks who experience mental health and substance use as barriers to education, it's an intersection of social justice work or activism and teaching and counseling, education, things like that. So it's just all of those things together that make me love my work.
Right. And what do you do? What are the, do you teach, do you develop? What are the things that you actually do as part of that program?
So I work with a team of faculty, and my specific role is to coordinate the workplace career development aspect of the program. So I work with students on sort of coming into the program, assessing their strengths and where they want to go, and then developing a plan for those next steps. I also supervise counselor trainees that we train at the site. So they work as supportive counselors to our students in the Redirection Through Education program. And I teach the courses related to career development. So there's a couple of those. And then I support students along with a work placement coach to create their own work placements and then do those work placements.
Mm. What would you say the top strengths or skills of your own that you draw on to be successful in your job?
I think it's probably my values. So my analysis comes very much from an anti-oppressive analysis. So my background is in community anti-violence work and community-based literacy. So that work has always been really motivated for me by a value of anti-oppression and equity and social justice. So, nice. And there's a bunch of skills, I guess, that go along with that.
Right. It's interesting that you responded with the values as being the strength. You're coming from a certain mindset or way of thinking and believing, mm-hmm. and that you consider a strength. It's always interesting to hear how people respond to that. David Revel, you now teach in Ryerson University's Disability Studies program. What do you like about that?
Oh, I love a lot of things about it. I love what it is I teach. I teach something unusual called Mad People's History. I love the students. The students that we teach are people who normally work full-time in the disability field. They're taking this course in their alleged spare time, and at the end of it, they get a Bachelor of Arts in Disability Studies and go on to use that education and training in their lives and work.
I'm going to find out more about your story, David, in a few minutes in the show. But can I just zero in on the skills and strengths that you're using now in your career? What do you draw on, skills, strengths, competencies to be successful?
I start with my own experience as a person who had a lot of experience as a user of mental health services, starting when I was a young man. And like Joe, I come at this from a social justice perspective. I don't believe that having a mental health or addictions issue should consign you to some kind of scrap heap. And I believe that people with mental health and addictions issues should be full citizens. And I moved from there into how do we help people get work that is satisfying and meaningful. And of course, one of the approaches is through education.
Right. I'm really excited about this topic because I think it's really important. We haven't quite touched on this topic on Career Buzz before, even though we've heard hundreds of career success stories. So I'm looking forward to getting more of your story. Now, Paul Zanetos, you're joining us here as the media relations consultant at George Brown. And I know you've also been deeply involved in this conference that's coming up, From Exclusion to Inclusion, Accessing Employment Through Education. What do you like about your job as a media relations consultant?
Well, before I begin, I'd like to mention that I guess during my final 2 years of my undergrad at Ryerson, I had some difficulties as well with mental health, depression and anxiety to be exact. And that lasted through to the first couple of years of my career as well, which was in public relations communications. And without the support of my family, friends, and my doctor, I probably wouldn't be here right now, not only discussing about my career, but discussing about life and just getting along and doing the things that we need to do to survive. So this conference is near and dear to me, and I'm very happy to be a part of it and to be supporting it through a PR perspective.
Great. And thanks for sharing that perspective and the personal connection. You know, much of the themes of the radio interviews here on Career Buzz have been at the intersection between career and life. I like to use that broad term, and I think most people are thinking about that. And I think what we've got here, especially around mental health issues and bringing them to light, is a really key topic. So great that you've been participating in building this conference. What skills and strengths do you draw on to be successful in your job as a media relations consultant?
It's been quite a ride. I started as just a writer with a very large Canadian corporation and writing their national newsletter, and then from there going into more of the PR part of things. And what I noticed was it really appealed to my ability to communicate with people, to get along with people, to create networks, to sell stories. And that lasted probably a good 6 years until I joined George Brown about 5.5 years ago. And what I discovered was that it was the first time in my entire career I was able to sell something that I really believed in. I wasn't pushing products, which was very nice. And I was actually supporting something that I truly believe in, which is education, especially at this level where I believe the college system is providing a large source of the workforce that's currently working in Ontario. And in this current economic environment, we need to be supporting this even more to make sure that we have the skilled trades per people available to build the bridges, to build the infrastructure, to expand on what is already out there. You might not know this, and this is something I tell on a regular basis, but a big portion of the healthcare workers that are out there right now are college grads.
Yes.
So we want to make sure that we continue this, and we're proud to say that we're opening up a new campus on the waterfront come September, and this will be a big part of growing that need for more healthcare workers now that things are going to be changing demographically in the province.
Absolutely. Thanks for sharing those perspectives. We're talking here to Paul Zanetos and Joe Petit, both at George Brown College, and David Revel, as part of our conversation about the intersection of mental health, learning, and employment. Here on Career Buzz, I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM. Joe Petit, you've been involved in this conference now for a while. Can you tell us a little bit more about the conference? What's the theme and what's it all about?
Sure. So the theme this year is really about how do folks sort of travel their path through education to employment, and I guess coming from the assumption that training and education is going to lead us to more sustainable and meaningful employment. So this is not just survival work. We're trying to support folks to experience, but the kind of thing that we're all talking about, where our values and skills are really put to use. So the conference, I think we've wanted to talk about this topic for a number of years because it's sort of our backyard. It's what we do as faculty and people working in the college. And I think it's great because we get to invite some folks in from the community who are really doing exciting work and have exciting perspectives. It's a really community-based conference this year. We've got four keynotes, three in the morning, one in the afternoon, and they all identify as psychiatric survivors or are MAD identified, which maybe David can talk a little bit about more later. So it's also coming from a perspective that education and employment are social determinants of health, that we become healthier by having meaningful employment, that we become more fulfilled in our lives and more self-actualized, and that mental health is on a continuum, and all of us are going to become healthier, happier people if we have employment that means something to us, and I certainly experienced that myself.
Do you have any data on that? That is so important. You said it really quickly, and I don't know if listeners really caught it, but that education and employment are social determinants of health. Now, I don't think people think about that too much. We have a health system that tries to fix problems as opposed to really try and be proactive. And here you're talking about things like education and employment, which are really proactive ways to make people healthy. What is the data? Do you have anything on the connection between education, employment, and health?
So I'm not a data person. David might have something, but the World Health Organization names both of those things as social determinants of health. And I think you're right that we're really used to seeing mental health as a medical problem, and therefore we fix the pathologies that individuals have, right? And I think that in these programs at George Brown, we're taking a really different approach, and I think our keynotes are taking a very different approach at this conference, which is the idea that supporting folks to changing society as opposed to changing the individual is going to create that different society where everybody's involved, everybody's included.
Yes.
To pick just one major mental illness, schizophrenia.
Yes.
For quite a long time now, we've known that the biggest single factor in recovery from schizophrenia is whether or not the person has a job. And this is pioneering work done by Richard Warner as long ago as the early 80s. So it's a no-brainer at this point that if you can get work, then it makes it so much easier to handle your mental health or addictions issues.
Yes, yes. David Revel, you're going to be speaking at the conference and keynoting, talking about the intersection of mental health, education, and employment. And in part, you're speaking, as you said before, from your personal history. I said in the intro that you have your own mental health story of an interrupted education. Can you take us back? What happened? Where does your story start, where the education, the mental health issues start to play a role in your story?
Well, my mental health crisis occurred while I was a student at U of T Law School just across the street from this studio. And I was about 20 years old, and I was in my second year at law school, and my parents were concerned about the way I seemed, and they suggested that I needed to see somebody, and to my surprise, the psychiatrist I saw had me taken immediately to hospital, and that said goodbye to my dreams of a law school a career, because I never went back. And in fact, it was a couple of years later when I was discharged from hospital, and the job I had at that moment was as a pot washer in an industrial kitchen.
Right, not quite a law associate at some firm doing your articles.
No, well, it was a different kind of working condition for sure. And Where I'm located now, I actually do some work with George Brown. So I have, for the last 9 years, I've been working with a sister program of the one that Joe works in. It's called Augmented Education. And it's targeted at people who have mental health and addictions histories. And what we're trying to do at George Brown is to get them a start in one of two great industries, the hospitality industry or the construction industry. And it's a program that fits in with a tradition that George Brown has developed of creating programs for people with mental health and addictions issues. And it's a wonderful experience. In this particular situation, I work as a consultant to the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, which partnered with George Brown on developing the augmented education program. And just last week, I was giving a lecture in that program. So I have a foot in two, both the college system and the university system. And but it is totally based on the personal experience I had with getting knocked out of the university career stream and starting over as a unskilled entry-level worker, which was not very successful. I had a number of entry-level clerical positions from which I either got fired or I walked, and that, of course, meant that I didn't have, I had an interrupted income and a low income. And I had a moment that you and I discussed before the show.
Yes.
Where suddenly it's a game-changing kind of moment. And the moment came when I got a job as a laborer with a plumbing contracting firm. And once I was there, it occurred to me, wait a minute, why don't I become a plumbing apprentice? And I did, and I went to George Brown College and got my plumbing papers. So now I had a skilled trade, and all of a sudden my life was a different kind of life.
Do you remember in that time before the turning point that you've just described, from having been a law student with some notion of some law career, having that interrupted, spending a couple of years in hospital, coming out and then doing, as you're saying, these other jobs one to another, what was your idea of who you were going to become in terms of a career at that time? Before the plumbing apprentice idea came up, who were you? What was the story you were telling yourself about the career plans, the career aspirations at that moment?
Well, unfortunately, I was telling myself the story that many people with mental health issues tell themselves, and that is that I was a loser, and that expectations that I had were now shattered, and that in fact I didn't have expectations. And so part of my journey was to rebuild that very human desire to have expectations about your life. And it's something that we sometimes miss, that if you've got an addictions problem or a mental health problem, does that mean you shouldn't aspire? And my message to people is, yes, you should, and yes, you can, but we've got to make some changes in two huge systems to make this work. And one huge system is healthcare, and the other huge system is education. And the good news is that in some small ways, we've figured out how to do this.
So can we come back to that? I do want to come back to the changes in the system, but just to continue with the story, because it's quite interesting and compelling, and listeners might not be familiar with stories like yours, where there was this signature career, if I can call it that, of law, then moving into a variety of other things, and now you're a plumbing apprentice. What happened in the story? What happened next?
You know what? As it turned out, being a plumbing apprentice was a brilliant stroke of fate, because one of the things that I couldn't do was plumbing. So I had to learn how to do that. Whereas when I was in entry-level clerical jobs, it wasn't challenging because I could do that. And in fact, the job expectations were pretty modest. So for me, having a big challenge of learning the theory and the practice of plumbing was extremely engaging. It was extremely difficult, but because it was in I didn't have to be down on myself, because why should I have known how to spin a thread on a pipe, right? You're not sort of born knowing that.
So you got to learn it. You got to go back to school. And as you say, you went to George Brown College at the time.
Part of the way you learn how to be a tradesman is by working with journeymen,
yes,
who teach you. And so there's a school component, but there's also a practice component. And I think for an adult learner, that's just a fabulous learning opportunity. And so I did have that. And the great thing about it was I then used other skills that had been dormant to take a trade and turn it into a business. And but that's missing out a key part of the story. One of the things that happened to me during those days and days and months in hospital was I had an opportunity to understand in a very personal way the stigma of mental illness and the way our society thinks about people who have mental health problems. And it made me mad.
Yes.
And so I resolved that I was going to try and do something about that. So once I had a plumbing business and could put food on the table for my family, I was also able to become an activist to try and do things about social justice. And it was my activist career that in some ways was the most inspiring to me. And it led me into electoral politics and into consulting and into being the advisor to the premier, so that although my career looks like a made-up story, there is a logical kind of progression to it that could be explained if somebody had the patience to listen to it.
We are listening to it here. We're talking to David Revel here on Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin.
I wasn't suggesting you were impatient.
It's coming out. It's being nurtured as we speak here on CIUT 89.5 FM. David, you just said something really interesting that a lot of people sort of say in one way or another when we talk to them about their career stories. It looks like a made-up story until you actually hear the glue that binds the pieces together. And we're starting to find that, and I think the turning points are the key thing. It's pretty remarkable to hear what you did up to the point in the story where we're at right now, where you built a plumbing business, and then to know that you were in elected politics. You were a member of provincial parliament, a city councillor. What was the beginning of that? You mentioned the activism, but somewhere along the line, somebody has to say something, or you have to get it in your head that you want to be a city councillor or a member of provincial parliament. What kicked that off?
I want to back this question up a little bit, if I may. One of the ingredients for success, for anybody's success, is social inclusion and social support. And one of the things that goes missing sometimes when you have mental health and addictions issue is you lose your social connections. And I was lucky in that I did get social support. So I wasn't doing this by myself. And one of the things that happens when you're an activist is that you work with other activists on a shared objective. And you get a ton of support from people like that. But the sine qua non of that is that you have to feel as though you're entitled to be engaged in public issues. And when you're feeling bad about yourself, you don't feel that you have anything to contribute. So there's a leap there that has to occur for people. Is if they've been found to be defective in some way in the way society views defects, How do they then realize, but wait a minute, I may have differences, I may have things about me that aren't the same as other people have, but I am still a person, I'm still a citizen, I still want to be engaged, and I'm going to be. And I got lucky because of the times, right? I'm thinking about
yes.
late 60s,
yes.
early 70s, people wanting to take control of their not just their lives, but their world. And so part of my story is an accident of timing. And part of the story as well is that I had a partner who wasn't worried about my mental health story and was also a social justice advocate in her life. And so once you start to, for instance, one of the things I worried about was poor people don't have access to legal services. Ah, law school's coming back here. So we started a storefront law office called Neighborhood Legal Services in 1972. It is still there. And I worked on that with a bunch of social justice advocates who had just emerged from law school. And they wanted to take on the question of poverty law, which at that time was not something lawyers wanted to do because,
nice.
Of course, poor people don't have any money, do they?
How did you feel making that link between your former law career and then these young lawyers wanting
I
to set up?
I love making that link.
Yeah, nice.
And you know, there are 71 legal clinics in Ontario today, and Neighborhood Legal was the very first one that had a community board. And so I feel great about that. And so once you're in, and of course the people that I was working with in the community law office often lived in rooming houses. And one of the problems, if you live in a rooming house, at that time you didn't have tenant rights. So you could come back to your room, find your stuff in a green garbage bag outside your door, and the lock has been changed. And that's because roomers had a license to occupy. They didn't have tenant rights. So that was one of the things that we were very concerned to fix about the law. And as luck would have it, when I was in the legislature, I brought in a law that gave boarders and roomers tenant rights. And so sometimes you get to make the circle, sometimes you don't.
Nice. It's pretty amazing. And just to hear at the end of the story, like when I was in the legislature, you know, I definitely want to... I want to follow up on that in a couple of minutes. We're just at about the halfway point of the interview here. So we're just going to take a quick break. I've been talking to Paul Zanetos, Joe Petit, and David Revel here on Career Buzz, a special edition of Career Buzz looking at the intersection between employment, mental health, learning, and career happiness. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, CIUT 89.5 FM. We'll be back with you in a moment.
Ever thought about studying abroad? Visit the Study and Go Abroad Fair on Sunday, March the 4th at the Metro Toronto Convention Centre to meet with universities from all around the world, offering diploma, undergrad and postgrad programs abroad. Find out more about our admission requirements, programs and scholarships. Check out our travel pavilion for volunteer and language or adventure travel. Doors open at 1 p.m, but come early at noon to catch our guest speaker from TalentEgg, Canada's most popular career website for graduate students. Find out more at studyandgoabroad.com, where you can pre-register to save time on the day and enter a grand prize draw.
We are over 4,200 education workers at U of T. We have been trying to negotiate a fair collective agreement for 10 months. We are asking for smaller labs and tutorial sizes, for more work opportunities and financial assistance for upper year graduate students, and to be paid for all the work that we do. We teach, we learn, we explore. We are the university.
We are the University of Toronto Education Workers, QP Local 3902.
From the roots up. CIUT 89.5 FM, broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
From Hart House,
University of Toronto.
Hey. And we're back at Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. And we've been talking to David Revel, Joe Petit, and Paul Zanetos here, leading up to a conference that's coming up on March 1st called From Exclusion to Inclusion, Accessing Employment Through Education. We were following through on David Revel's quite interesting zigzagging journey through his career. And David, just to kind of wind up with that story, I'm wondering if you can maybe just touch on one or two key turning points that listeners might want to hear. I think it's curious about how people do get into electoral politics. If there's some key turning point for you that led either to being a member of provincial parliament and or the City of Toronto Council, what's a couple of key turning points that you can share from that part of your experience?
Well, the first thing that happened was that the woman with whom I was in love was working on John Sewell's city council campaign, and she and I went and canvassed in St. Jamestown for John Sewell in 1972. And I got a taste for electoral politics. And the next campaign, I actually got a role in the campaign organization as the sign chairman. That's the person who organizes the part of the campaign that puts up lawn signs and porch signs and window signs.
Yeah.
And the next election that came out, I got to be the bag man. I got to be the fundraiser for the campaign. And so now I was learning the backroom part of electoral politics. And as it happened in 1980, I was on a search committee for a person who would stand in what is now called, it's the Cabbage Town might be a way to
yes.
locate the area. At that time it was Ward 7. And in those days there were two aldermen for each ward. And Gordon Cressy was looking for a teammate, and we talked to a lot of community leaders. And at some point in this exercise, somebody turned to me and said, "You should run." And to my surprise, my wife said, "Yeah, you should." And so off of about 10 years of working on issues as an activist in the East End, I surprisingly stepped into the electoral role, and because my teammate really understood the business of electoral politics, I got elected twice to city council, and then I made a decision that I wanted to step up a level to provincial politics. There was a vacancy in what is now called Toronto Danforth.
Yes.
I won a nomination race for the NDP and won two elections. So that was there was a kind of a transition from a person who was a person doing grassroots community activism to a worker on election campaigns to a person who sat on election planning committees to becoming the person for whom the election planning committee is established. So it wasn't planned, it evolved. And again, I think that's what happens to many people in their lives, is that you do stuff and then doors open.
The one thing that I caught in the story, and thanks for sharing that, was surprisingly. There was this word surprisingly that you said a moment ago about your accepting the nomination or you're taking on that opportunity to go for Toronto City Council. Had it not crossed your mind, you've been an activist, you've been involved in all these elections, and you kind of portray it as a kind of surprise. It came completely out of the blue. Had it not crossed your mind to run?
What I was hanging around with politicians, some of whom I admired tremendously, and certainly I was turned on to the potential that politics had for making real change in people's lives by John Sewell, whose project was to get the people whom decisions were going to affect to participate in the decision-making process. And at In the 60s in the city of Toronto, the council was run by guys with cigars who wanted to build tall buildings. And John's view was that the neighbors really should be deciding what happened in their city. And that turned me on because it was about citizens participating. And that's always been my issue, is that people should participate in life, right? That's what full citizenship is. So I was extremely excited by that notion. But the notion of actually being the guy,
yes,
who's knocking on the door,
yes,
saying, "Hello, my name's David, and I'd like your support," was a leap that took me quite a few years to get ready to make. And once I had made it, I wasn't always sure that it was the right leap to have made either, because the life of a politician has benefits and negative aspects to it as well.
It parallels, the way I'm hearing your story, it parallels the moment that you mentioned earlier when you talked about feeling as you need to be entitled to be engaged. It was the thing that led up to your moment where you finally said to yourself, "I'm going to be a plumbing apprentice." And it was that desire to be engaged. It was like a leap, you say. And then it happened once in your career, and then it sounds like it's almost a parallel experience.
Well, it's happened a whole bunch of times in my career, because if now I'm an adjunct professor at Ryerson University. It never would have occurred to me 20 years ago that I might end up as an academic. And the reason I'm there is because of the rest of my life. And so unlike career academics who go to university forever and then stay in the university forever, that's not the way it went. And in a way, I'm glad it didn't go that way. And in other ways, I'm sorry it didn't go that way, because there are advantages in that kind of deep immersion in the academy that I don't have. But I have other real-world experiences of many kinds that I can bring to my teaching. But I can go take this into the conference, for instance.
Yes.
One of the keynote speakers is Professor Jeffrey Rayon. And I know a lot about his life story, and I'm going to be a little bit cautious about what I tell you, because I don't want to speak for him. But I can speak to things that he has written about. When he was a teenager, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and was hospitalized as a teenager and dropped out of school entirely. And at one point in his life, he filled shampoo bottles as his work for a community agency that was running a sheltered workshop, which fortunately we don't have any of anymore. And he went back to school as an adult, got a PhD, and decided that his work as a medical historian was going to be based on the lives of people who lived in the Toronto Lunatic Asylum, now called the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, because we've had an asylum here since 1850. And he did something unique as a historian, which was to go into the archives and read the letters that patients had written that were confiscated by the administration of the hospital in those days and kept in an archive. And he has built an extraordinary academic career that also relates to his life experience as a mental patient, and he's going to be one of the keynote speakers. And he's going to talk about how the past connects to the future, and of how even 50 years ago, how patients worked in the hospital and on the hospital grounds for no wages. And in fact, he will probably tell that it was patients who built the wall that kept them in.
Amazing. We're talking to David Revel here. He's telling us about the upcoming conference called From Exclusion to Inclusion, Accessing Employment Through Education. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're also talking to Joe Petit and to Paul Zanetos. And I wonder if I could bring the two of you into the conversation and just get a bit of each of your stories that brings you to this area that we're talking about today. Joe, take me back. How far back does your interest in helping people go?
I don't know if I would call it an interest in helping people. I would maybe see it more as an interest in sort of walking alongside folks as they experience themselves, as I experience myself.
Nice way to put it.
The helping thing hasn't been a motivating piece for me. I was just thinking, listening to David's story, that this may be the first time that I've ever taken a retrospective look at my career, because it's really so new. I'm kind of a baby. So it's really only been. I've been at George Brown for 4 years, I had just gotten my master's degree in social work at that point, and had been working in the community at a community-based literacy program before that, and also doing peer support work at the Toronto Rape Crisis Center, which was a huge. I think that's kind of where most of my analysis and experience came from, and I draw every day on the incredible teachings of the women in that organization, and the learning from the organization in general, being a grassroots organization coming out of the feminist movement, very very small organization doing really powerful work. So what was your question?
Well, it was what brought you. Mm-hmm. The way you've put it now is that you like to call it walking alongside mm-hmm. people as they experience themselves, I think is more or less how you said that, as opposed to helping people, which was more a simplified version that I had said. And I was wondering what brings you to that. You know, you got a master's in social work. There may be people listening who have similar interests. Mm-hmm. So just to find out the motivation, the thing that was mm-hmm. going on in your life that led you this way and not any other way.
So I remember a turning point, which is after moving to Toronto, and having moved from Vancouver, where I'd spent the better part of a decade working as a bike courier, and I'd had an experience of loving my work, definitely doing that work. It was great to wake up every day and enjoy what I did, but at the same time, sometime during that, when I was doing that work, I started to feel that there. I wasn't connected to the work. My values weren't being lived out, and I was at the same time doing a lot of reading. So doing just sort of self-educating, and doing a lot of reading, contextualizing my life experience within feminism. So when I came to Toronto, I remember sitting in the Palmerston Library around the corner from where I was staying with my brother when I first moved here, and seeing a program at George Brown. Actually, it's interesting. David and I are both graduates of George Brown, a program at George Brown called the Assaulted Women's and Children's Counselor Advocate Program. And it was while I had had an interest in sort of social service type programs and social service type work, this was the first program I'd seen described as coming from that kind of perspective. So it hit me right away, and it seemed like, and it also at the time I was intimidated by the idea of being in school. So it seemed like a two-year program and I can get to work. That seemed really intriguing to me, and it turned out that after the 2 years in that program, which were amazing, that I wanted to keep going with school. So I went on to do a Bachelor of Social Work and a Master's of Social Work.
But not a small amount of additional education.
Right.
There.
It just kept getting more and more fun, actually, because I got to ask more and more specific questions that I had. So whereas this education is all sort of, you might think from the outside, it's related to helping people, counseling, social work, and so on. I always tried to find the piece that was about social justice and the politics of helping, right, and being critical of that. So whereas I don't identify as a psychiatric survivor, I haven't been psychiatrized. I think all of us have mental health experiences along a continuum, and I think there's a lot related to your social location and your privilege in terms of, like, if I had been in a different situation, I could have been psychiatrized, right? And in certain times in my life, I think many of us could, depending on what types of, David was mentioning social supports, what types of social supports we have. So I guess I may be coming from the location of being a bike courier and being in a little bit of a subculture and being a little bit of a badass, if I could say that. I sort of came at the work in the same way, and I had to make it fit me. So it's interesting that I ended up in the Redirection Through Education program, being a mental health program, because I didn't focus in any way in my education on mental health. I focused on the impact of violence on learning. I focused on social justice. I focused on education, on teaching anti-oppression. My master's thesis was really about how we teach anti-oppression to our students' emotions and bodies, not just their intellects. So that was always really fascinating to me. So as I was working in Parkdale at a literacy program, I got this amazing opportunity to teach an outreach literacy group at Parkdale Activity Recreation Center, which has been around for a long time in Parkdale. It's a drop-in center originally I think it started as a drop-in center for folks who had been institutionalized at Lakeshore Hospital and then moved into the community. And so it was a place for people to go and receive social support. And it's I shouldn't be here describing Park because I really just did a literacy group there. But it's a really interesting organization, member run and operated. So I started doing the literacy work there, and that's kind of how I got connected to working in mental health. It wasn't at all from a place of learning clinical counseling, or it was about teaching folks whose education had been interrupted, who had, as adults, had lower levels of literacy and wanted to work on that and wanted to write their stories. And it was amazing work. And
yes.
And I went sort of straight from there to George Brown.
It's a good story of connecting the dots in ways that those dots don't seem to connect if you just looked at them, you know, outside the context of a human story, especially the part about the badass career. You know, and we did a show just a couple of weeks ago just on cycling and how cycling and an interest in cycling can lead to career happiness. And we had five guests who had these amazing stories of taking an interest in cycling and moving it into their career. And, you know, that connecting that dot, I think, is really interesting. And if listeners are interested in thinking, gee, you know, maybe I'm interested in doing a master's in social work, something that a lot of people are interested in, it's interesting to hear how people come at that from such different backgrounds. So thanks for sharing that story. And Paul, I wonder if I can hear a bit from you. You mentioned right off the top that you did have some experience with mental health challenges, and through that, that has actually informed some of your career. What happened?
Well, to be exact, I remember it being my third year of journalism school at Ryerson and not being able to concentrate, finding the everyday things very tough. And I'd like to go into more detail, but I don't want to go back to that dark place again. But what ended up happening was I ended up having, you know, I'm not sure what they're called anymore, but I think David and I once described them as episodes. And having some time off, I think in a different time, I might have been in the hospital as well. I was lucky enough to have that support and to get through that period with a lot of help and a treatment that was good for me. And from there, things haven't changed, and I'm able to do a better job now of handling the day-to-day. And actually, I've never been in a happier place. I am a husband, a father of two beautiful little girls, and I'm in a career that I enjoy, but at this point in time, I'm in a transition period as well. Through my employer, I'm doing a master's in education, and through my love for education, I'm hoping to take that and take it to the next step and hopefully either teach or counsel students in getting to that stage where they want to be, and that is get work. And so hopefully I can take what I have right now and take it to the next level and maybe be a part of administration or faculty. But it's just one of those things where, again, it's a transition that just comes through what you enjoy, what you value, and you know, just being yourself, really.
Great. Thanks for sharing that part of your story. And it's impressive to hear how you've really moved forward, and you still have great plans for the future and doing the master's in education. So good luck with that.
Thank you.
Now, David, back to you. One of the things that was mentioned earlier was the MAD movement. And I know some of the courses that you teach relate to that. And I was curious about that. And I think there's something to what we're talking about here in this conference that relates to this notion of the MAD movement. So I'd like to ask you a bit about that. And I'd also invite listeners, if you have any experiences along the lines of what we're talking about here at the intersection of mental health, learning or education and employment, drop me a line, send me an email. I can read it on the air and we can discuss it. The email address is mark@careercycles.com. That's Mark with a K at careercycles.com. So if you have any thoughts or comments or questions about that, drop me a note right now and I'll pick it up and I'll read it on the air, or a question for any of our guests here. So David, over to you, the MAD movement. Psychiatric survivors, this whole notion here of coming back around and now claiming a place in the world. What can you tell us about that?
The MAD movement started at the same time as a number of much more famous liberatory movements started, like the women's movement and the student movement and the gay and lesbian movement and the American Indian movement and civil rights movement. Although it was earlier, but we were all informed for struggles for justice that were undertaken by people that had particular characteristics. And I spend a semester talking to students about the MAD movement, which takes us back to the 60s and carries on into the present. When we started the movement back in the 60s, we called it the Mental Patients Liberation Movement. And over time, the movement has had a change of name as the experience of people has changed. So those of us who started the movement had a lot of experience with being locked up in asylums, which is not a common experience today, thank goodness. But the MAD movement is just a self-help movement, mutual aid movement, political movement, liberatory movement that, if I have my way, will become as well known about as, say, feminism is. And so it's a movement that takes is interested in a social construction of the idea of madness rather than a medical construction that we call mental illness.
Social construction. So the idea being there that these are ideas that we've created as opposed to a medical pathology.
That's right. And the thing about pathology is that the problem is located within an individual, whereas a broader approach would be to say that there are many influences on us, and we know because we know what the social determinants of health are, we know that whether you have a job, whether you have decent housing, whether you have friends, whether you have adequate income, also has an effect on your health and your mental health.
So it's pretty interesting then to hear about that. Do we have any sense of the numbers? How big is this movement, or at least people who might call themselves psychiatric survivors in a country like Canada?
The movement is small. And the movement is small because it still is difficult for people to talk openly about their mental health and addictions issues, not surprisingly, because of how we stigmatize people with mental health and addictions issues. So the people in the MAD movement are people who, for whatever reason, have decided that they're going to embrace aspects of their identity in the same way as people who call themselves queer have done. So the activists with whom I work have reclaimed a word that used to be a negative, pejorative word, MAD, and turned it into a descriptor which is more celebratory.
And Joe, now in the class that you teach, it's called Redirection Through
Education. That would be the program. Mm-hmm.
What are some of those people, what are their, not their stories, and we were going to have somebody who actually was going to share her story mm-hmm. there, but what can you tell us about the people who come to that? What kinds of experiences are they coming from? And then what happens to them in the program and afterwards?
So it's a cool question because it's an incredibly diverse program and there would be multiple stories, I think, coming out of that question. The cool thing about the program is it's really a transitional program. So it's not a program where everybody has the same sort of outcome at the end, such as like a training program would, where everybody has to sort of be able to perform the same skills at the end of the program. So it's really the way that I describe it to my students is, you know, this is sort of to support you to direct your own way from point A to point B in your life. And everybody's point A is different and everybody's point B is going to be different. And so, you know, the one commonality is that folks have identified themselves as wanting to move forward in their lives in some way or another. And as having mental health or substance use challenges as one of the things that they're dealing with. And we know, of course, that means that probably many of them also have, you know, histories of violence that they're dealing with or poverty that they've dealt with or are dealing with, or experiences with social assistance or with the mental health system or the medical model and medical system. Our students identify in many, many different ways. It's as diverse as the students are, really. So it's hard to, there's not one story, but really it's a story of transition and movement and self-determination. That's a really sort of core value, is that they direct their own path from point A to point B with the structure and support of the program.
And for instance, Teresa, who was going to be here, but
yeah,
she wasn't, well,
amazing story.
And she's now called the Community Poverty Relief Associate at a relief organization called Via Havta.
Yeah. So she went through our program. She also did many other things as well. She really filled her life with interesting things and educational opportunities. She did also Voices from the Street, which is a program out of the Ontario Council of Alternative Businesses, working with psychiatric survivors to work on boards of directors, and it's a speakers bureau, so they do public speaking. And so Teresa did a bunch of different things, and kind of she's incredibly resourceful, and she kind of created her own job out of a placement she did when she did the social service worker program at George Mann. So she moved on from RTE, from Redirection Through Education, into the social service worker program at George Brown. And many of our students, that's one of the things that we're pretty successful at, is moving students from Redirection Through Education into a post-secondary program at George Brown, because then they're familiar with the campus, and they have a sort of a home base at the college, and they're familiar with our courses. Kind of, we have some post-secondary courses in our program. A lot of our courses and our timetable kind of mimic a post-secondary full-time program. So
sounds great, and we'll have to have some of your graduates back on the show to talk about their stories. Now we just have a minute left, and I'm wondering if I could bring it back to the personal and ask you in just maybe one point that you can share from your own personal stories that we've now heard on Career Buzz. What's one thing that you can share with listeners about what you've learned from your own story about making good career and life choices? One thing that you've learned about making good career and life choices. David, if I can start with you.
I think it's a question of being able to see where there's an opportunity and being ready to seize the opportunity. And as I say to people, if you do stuff, stuff happens. I'm hoping that people will do stuff, and I think things will happen.
Joe?
I think build good allyships and relationships, both with the people that you work with and people that you can learn from. It's interesting to be sitting next to David, because when I first started at RTE, I was well advised to invite him out for a coffee just to get some
yes,
perspective from the community, and I've learned so much from that, and I think I hadn't talked about the identity of a mad positive professional, which is, I think, my alternative to a mental health worker. I'm still working on that identity, but it's coming together.
Nice. And Paul, from you?
Just follow your heart. Do what you want to do. Life is too short to do things you don't want to do.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz. I really appreciate you sharing your stories, your personal stories here.
Good to be
on
here.
Career Buzz. You have been listening to Career Buzz.